Today's program is brought to you by Neil's Yard Dairy, selecting, maturing, and selling farmhouse cheese from the UK and Ireland. For more information, visit neilsyarddairy.uk.co.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Cutting the Curd, broadcasting live on the Heritage Radio Network. This is Greg Blaze, and today I'm really happy to have Kalila Jaffe on the line. How are you, Kalila?
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure. Originally, Kalila was going to join me here in the studio, but I hear you're stranded out on the West Coast because of this recent blizzard.
I am. I was on transit back from Hawaii, and I've ended up in L.A. for a few days, so... Unexpected bonus.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's not bad. I mean, you could be, like, somewhere horrible, which would be bad.
Yeah. No, LA's great. It's sunny and 70 degrees. I can't complain.
Yeah, man. I can. I was just out in San Fran for the Fancy Food Show. A little different than LA, obviously, but I ate a ton of great food. I hope you're eating well while you're out there.
Definitely.
Awesome. So here in Cutting the Curd, we usually have cheesemongers and cheesemakers, other cheese-associated professionals and people on to talk cheese with us. But today, I'm really happy to have a non-cheese business person to give us an anthropology and archaeology lesson about cheese and how our favorite ruminant animals became domesticated. So Kalila is a food academic extraordinaire. She's a doctoral candidate in the food studies program at NYU, where she's also the food program coordinator. Her research includes past food ways, domestication, and zoo archaeology. And she's conducted field research in Fiji, New Zealand, and Hawaii. I'm supposing that's what you were doing in Hawaii when you were out there? Or were you just vacationing?
Visiting the museum and colleagues.
Pretty awesome.
It's not a bad place to work.
No, man. Anytime you get a gig in Hawaii, you're doing well, you know?
Yeah.
So before...
Limited cheese scene, actually.
What's that?
A very limited cheese scene in Hawaii.
Oh, totally.
Everything shipped in. You know, there's very, very little limited local production, so...
Yeah, I used to sell some cheese out there to the... to the Whole Foods when I worked in California, and I always led a dream because I'm from such like a cold place. I was like, I'm gonna open up a cheese shop in Hawaii, and I can wear next to no clothing and sell cheese. But it probably cost me like three times as much to get everything out there.
You know? Probably, yeah.
So, before we talk about cheese, I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit more about your research interest, because I think when folks think of food, or more specifically when they think about cheese, like archaeology is one of the last things that come to mind, which is a shame. But what's digging up old things have to do with food?
Yeah, what people are always surprised to find out about archaeology is that we spend a whole lot of time talking about diet and food. A lot of what we deal with in terms of the physical evidence that we're actually out there digging up, excavating, is old garbage, old trash.
Right.
And when we're talking about societies, particularly the older, the further back you go, the large portion of their days were taken up with subsistence activities. A large amount of time was spent each day growing, cooking, making food. And so it's not surprising that most of what we find in the leftovers and the middens and the trash heaps is they're all things that are directly related to diet. And diet tells us just an absolute huge amount about what people used to do, how people used to live, and the amount of information you can tease out of old food waste is pretty spectacular. Food studies is fairly new within the last 10 to 15 years and a lot of other disciplines, and I have colleagues that would talk about going to speak to colleagues who don't have anything to do with food, and they were like, yeah, but you study food, like, what is that? Is that like a real thing?
Right.
And that's never existed in archaeology, because a lot of what we've always done is directly related to subsistence activities. A really good example of that is you can look at, so what I do is called zooarchaeology, where I specialize in analyzing the remains of animals, old animal bones, shells, teeth, that kind of stuff. And looking at those animal remains, we can tell things like not only what animals they were eating, but how old those animals are, whether the animals were male or female. That information alone is enough to let you know what the herd structures were like.
Sure.
And we know what herd patterns look like because if you're looking at, say, a dairying economy, you know that you're going to expect to see lots of older females and very young males because the males are culled out. The females are kept for dairy production until they're no longer productive, at which point they're culled and eaten. And just by having that information, we now know that we're looking at a predominantly pastoralist society and what that means for the economics, what that means for the social structure. It, all of that information kind of falls into place based on the food waste. So that's kind of food and archaeology in a nutshell.
Oh, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, there's certain, like, the cliche things that we say, like, you are, you know that horrible saying, like, you are what you eat. But it makes a lot of sense to me, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that way, or I think about food that way a lot. One of the reasons why I love to work with cheese is its window into I always look at it. A lot of times it's my job, so I mean I'm not pretend that I'm thinking this every second that I'm working, but it's a window for me into the past or into culture, you know, and by studying the animals, which I'm not as good at studying the animals because I'm not a farmer, I can learn about the things that you're talking about, you know, and that's pretty cool stuff. I think that's and it makes a lot of sense. I mean. When there's no supermarket, you got to spend your time, gathering food to eat. You gotta survive. So, what do we know about the history, like, of milking cows? Like, how they went from like wild ox to the wide variety of like milking breeds that we know of today?
There's actually a lot of very interesting research coming out right now. A lot of it is genetic. But there's archaeological evidence to support all that genetic work about the origins of dairying, and we know that cattle or cows were domesticated probably around 10,000 years ago, give or take. They've been around for quite a while. They are extremely different than their wild progenitors, which was called the aurochs, which was a big, nasty, wild oxen thing.
Nice.
And they actually didn't die out completely until the Middle Ages, interestingly. There were still a couple floating around in the forest, like the deep forests of Europe. But it has been a very long time since an aurochs has actually walked the earth, which is one of the things that I think is hilarious when people talk about, like, oh, wild cows. I had a vegetarian once tell me that we should just let all the cows go free.
Yeah, that's a great
idea.
And I was like,
but what would happen to them? They're like, oh, they become wild cows. And I was like, you mean feral cows? Because wild cows they're not a thing anymore.
They probably wouldn't be too receptive.
Yeah. The cows that we have now are very clearly selected for some very specific character traits. They're quite a bit smaller than the wild aurochs was. They were probably selected to be more docile. The wild aurochs would have been a big, fairly nasty creature. You can look at some of the behavior of some of the other wild bovids out there, like the Cape buffalo, which is one of the deadliest animals in Africa, to kind of understand what you were starting with there, as opposed to Bessie the dairy cow, who will come when she's called.
Sure.
Very, very different creatures. That was probably the first selection criteria, is really just something that humans could work with without having to fear for their lives, because they'd be pretty, pretty intimidating creatures. And
well, it's a big animal, like, it's like a large thing. They just sort of like, I don't know, man. I don't know. You figure they had to go to a place where, they'd allow like humans to like pull on them and extract their milk out, that takes a while to get there, I imagine.
Yeah, to just convince them to, even let you approach them,
right,
is pretty spectacular. And there are certain things that make animals easier to domesticate than other wild behaviors that we can exploit. Herd animals are ideal because
sure.
They can be kind of clumped together. They're happy to live together. It makes them easier to control because you get a hold of one and the others will kind of stick around. Animals that tend to flee when confronted instead of defend are not ideal. Like if you took a whole bunch of deer and you tried to walk up to them, they kind of split up in every direction and run. Versus if you walk up to American bison are a good example. You walk up to an American bison, and what they're going to do is they're just going to clump together even closer.
Sure, that makes sense.
And that's their defensive mechanism. So it makes things like living in a barn not too terribly stressful for them because they like to live all clumped together.
Yeah, they like to be close to each other, right?
Yeah, so definitely something that they would have selected for. You know, early domestication may have focused more on, you know, meat, leather, what we would call terminal goods, the things you have to kill animals to get out of them. Because dairying would have come a little bit later. The thing about dairying, which I'm sure you're aware of, probably many of your listeners, is cows have to be convinced to let down their milk.
Sure.
And if they're stressed, if they're angry, they will not release milk. So we had to get them to a point where they were used to handling, they were okay with people enough to be able to actually be milked. The other thing that is interesting about early dairying is that for a long period of time in cattle's history, they probably had to have the calf present. Nowadays, a cow is bred. The calf is, you know, kept with the cow for as little as a few days in some practices before it's removed, and then the cow can be milked for anywhere from, you know, 9 months to almost a year. In early dairy production, you would have had the calf right there, and you let the calf feed, and then you kind of push the calf aside, and you reach under and hope that she thinks that it's still the calf.
Yeah.
There's all kinds of tricks that were probably used. There's some good papers out there about behaviors that you can kind of mock to.
People still do that now. Well, they do it more.
Yeah.
I've heard of it more, and I wanted to get your timeline on sheep and goat, because goat is mostly where I've heard of, you know, the animals being fooled into giving up their milk by a certain lighting system that, like, you know, that makes them think that they're supposed to lactate, you know, at a certain period of time. I mean, because those animals they lactate in a much different cycle. I mean, you can get cows to give milk probably a lot, or I'm just speculating, a lot easier than sheep or goat off of the cycle, their natural, like, cycle of lactation, correct?
Yeah. My understanding is that out of the big three, the sheep, the goat, and the cows, that it is really the sheep out of those three is the most difficult. The cows are, you know, the most.
What about water buffalo? Because that's the one I always hear that is really, really difficult to get the milk out of. Like, they're stubborn, obstinate. If they're not super comfortable, they don't give you anything.
Yeah, water buffaloes are the divas of the milking world. I've heard stories about water buffaloes in the middle of it being in the middle of milking and have, like, a tractor or car drive by on the road. And if they get even slightly distracted, they will just.
It's like, we're not doing this.
Yeah. And I actually just read a very interesting article about one of the few buffalo dairy producers here in the United States, how he's able to lure his buffalo into a windowless shed, and he takes them in one at a time into this windowless shed, because by removing the windows, they can't have, like, a stranger walk by.
I mean, they're not going to lie to you. That sounds pretty, like, illegal. It sounds like pretty shady activity to, like, lead those in. I'm just kidding.
I don't think they're living in a shed. One thing that is also they're known for is the buffalo make all the decisions in these milking situations.
Right.
The farmer gets to kind of coax whatever they can out of them. Generally, they have to be milked by somebody they know. You can't have, like, a random new hire go and milk a water buffalo. They'll only be milked by the same person every day. They really are that particular about the situation. And they're also, they're not huge producers. A regular dairy cow in the U.S., most of our dairy breeds, can produce up to 50 pounds of milk a day. And you're lucky if you get 15 pounds out of a water buffalo there.
We did an episode last fall about like water buffalo cheese. I learned a ton, it was really interesting to me, to just the whole history of the water buffalo. I found pretty awesome, you know, or just the thought of it. I had some people asking me a lot at the cheese counter where, like, how water buffalo got into Italy. And I had my own insights, and I was wondering if maybe you could tell me if I were right or wrong. Like, I thought, what I thought is that they were brought down, or what I've been told is they had been brought down by, like, the Goths, like the Visigoths, and then the Visigoths had, like, sort of gotten them from the Khans, like, who had brought them over, like, when they, like, sort of came and rampaged through Eastern Europe. Am I just out of my mind there, or is that somewhat correct?
That's the general path that they would have to have taken. They were originally domestic. There's actually two distinct groups of water buffaloes. They call them the swamp buffaloes, which is what you see more in Eastern Asia, and then out of the Indus Valley about 4,000 years ago, what they call the river buffalo, which is the type of buffalo that's ended up in Italy.
Right.
They can interbreed. It's actually fairly rare. They have a different number of chromosomes between those two groups. And they would have had to have come up, you know, out of India and the Indus Valley area into Central Asia, out through the Middle East, to kind of distribute through there. So it is those great, you know, migrations and movements of people up and out of that area, and then finally down into the Italian peninsula.
That makes sense. I mean, it just makes sense to me. I mean, I listened to her a lot about just – and this is a little off topic, but it's just about the path of the Khans coming through, you know, and how what they did to Eastern Europe, and I just had done a tiny bit of research there. So I'm glad that the information that I gave out wasn't completely false.
most of the buffalo that would have been coming through were animals that are primarily used for traction.
Right.
On water buffaloes is kind of a secondary product. Traction or pulling carts. Plows is their main purpose. They're such a large animal, which is funny because they do have this reputation for being such divas, and that they'll only do when they want to do, and you can't even get them to walk across the yard unless they want to walk across the yard. But at the same time, they have successfully been taught to, pull a plow. They're very important in maintaining rice paddies in Europe because they do enjoy the water so much and are a large beast of burden. So there would have had been, there has to be some flexibility there with them.
Sure.
In order to get them to do double duty.
You said the goats are pretty easy. They give it up. But I was wondering, so why are the sheep so hard to give the milk? I mean, and cheesemakers may know, but what's your take on that? Why don't they want to give it up?
The same general reasons. Their breeding season is shorter, which is one reason that will actually reduce their productivity, is that lambs, because they're smaller animals, lambs simply grow up quicker,
right,
which means that these sheep won't produce for as long. And the amount of milk that they produce at once is a smaller amount. They are, you can almost liken it to grazing behavior, where little lambs will come up and they'll have a little bit to eat, and then they go off and do something else and nibble, and then they'll come back and have a little bit to eat, which also makes, you know, a twice-a-day milking routine more difficult versus cows, which, of course, we've bred to. You know, they carry these huge udders. They'll produce
lots of milk,
pounds of milk, you know, like in a few minutes. And it's something that's been very selective there. Sheep and goat milk is probably some of the first milk in the kind of Neolithic package that people were using, but it was probably in pretty small quantities. Originally, they thought that when these animals, both sheep and goats were domesticated in the Middle East. There's actually probably a couple of different areas that cows were domesticated. We've got the Zebu cattle coming out of the Indus Valley, as well as, you know, a Middle Eastern strain. And that's the beginning of the Neolithic, where we have, you know, the origins of agriculture and food production for the very first time. And these animals spread very quickly through most of the Old World. And it was originally thought that animal husbandry spread. The sheep, the goats, the cows moved all over the place, but it was, again, traction, where the cows were pulling plows or, you know, pulling wagons, things along those lines, and also meat and leather and wool. It now seems that the dairying was actually part of this original first expansion. There's been some very interesting evidence, not only in terms of genetics, but they're pulling ceramics out of various places in Europe, various places in the Middle East, where they're doing chemical residue analysis of the insides of these pots. And what they're discovering through that residue analysis is that it contains milk protein.
I mean, they're making cheese in there, man. They're making yogurt and cheese in those pots, right?
Making yogurt and cheese in those pots because fresh milk, particularly in a hot climate, isn't going to be good for more than an hour.
Nope.
It turns over very, very quickly. So in order to make that an edible product that can be kept or used for anything else, particularly if you're trying to store a little bit of surplus food for when things, you know, aren't going so great, you're going to be having to turn those into workable products pretty quickly.
Yep. And interestingly enough, I actually want you to talk about that with us. That's specifically what you're talking about. But first, we're going to take a tiny break, and we're going to come back in just a second and expand on that. Thanks a lot.
Today's program is brought to you by Neil's Yard Dairy. Neil's Yard Dairy selects, matures, and sells farmhouse cheese from the UK and Ireland. They work with about 40 cheesemakers. They visit them regularly to taste their cheese and select the batches they want to mature and sell. Amongst the cheeses they select, there's a great deal of variability. Cheese can change hugely depending on how it's treated. They have a range of temperature and humidity-controlled maturation facilities at their warehouse in London, run by a team who are dedicated to ensuring they sell their cheese at its best. As the cheese is maturing, they continue to taste through the stock to ensure they're aware of how it is developing over time. When the cheese is ready, their attention turns to directing the right cheese into the hands of the right customer. They have 3 cheese shops in London, an online shop, and they're a regular site at markets around the country and have a UK and international wholesale trade. For more information, visit neilsyarddairy.uk.co.
So welcome back to Cutting the Curd. On today's episode, we're talking with food studies doctoral candidate, anthropologist, and general smarty pants, Khalilah Jaffe. We were just chatting about animal domestication, and that led us into this interesting spot where archaeology and archaeologists have discovered these pots, these ceramic pots that contain milk proteins. And that leads me into an interesting question about a legend that I've spread and that I think a bunch of people have had fed to them. You know, so we're going to turn our attention directly to cheese again for a minute and talk. So, Khalilah, I think like most of us who work in the cheese biz have heard this story about this Arabian merchant who put milk in a pouch made from sheep's stomach and like traveled through the desert on a hot day and then accidentally discovered cheese or yogurt thousands of years ago through this process of the stomach acids in the sheep skin, you know, coagulating the milk and turning it into yogurt. So I was wondering if you had heard that story before.
I have heard that story. That specific told just like that from some of my cheesemonger friends, actually. But it's probably not far off.
That's cool.
The first yogurt products were almost certainly, and it's one of these things where in archaeology you almost never find the first instance or something.
Right.
Out of everything that happens with the human past, we get a very small fraction of a percent actually leaves physical records behind for us to analyze. But with these early ceramics that we do have, we know that they had these milk proteins in them. We know that, you know, milk will go sour or go bad very quickly in hot climates. So it's very likely that they would put some milk into a container of some sort, come back to it a couple of hours later, discover that it has gotten sour and kind of chunky. That yogurt, as soon as you have one that tastes good, when you get your next batch of milk, you take a spoonful of that and add it into it, which allows you to control the types of bacteria and the strains that you're using, which will help control the flavor of the product, is probably exactly how it happened. In terms of, you know, the first use of rennet and the first use of cheese, you know, using that ruminant stomach that would have a little bit of that in there as a container, we do know that, you know, those types of containers would probably have been pretty common, is a very likely story for how cheese came into being.
I like it. I like that. So I want to ask you, like, and this is weird, like, but you know, like, but it's a good question. So why should, like, you know, why should we care so much about the origins of cheese and the origins of domesticating ruminant animals in terms of, do you think that this can help us out, like knowing this history can help us out today with our current issues in cheese?
I think that there's definitely a lot of interest in the, you know, the current cheese world in recapturing lost arts and the way things used to be, particularly in kind of the pre-industrial period and emphasis on craftsmanship. So I think that there is a lot of interest in terms of helping with environmental problems are kind of larger societal problems. I don't know if there's necessarily an answer there to that, but I definitely think that it tells the story of not only the past of this product of cheese, of cows, but it also tells the human story. And I think that it's very important for, us as a society or us as, the human race to understand how we developed and where we came from and that, contribution to the greater human knowledge.
Yeah, I always liked I love cheese, obviously, but one of the reasons why I love it so much is because it contains all of this, for me, contains a lot of locked-in memory, so I sort of reel in old experiences through eating, through eating the cheese or handling it, through the sensory things that, that happened to me in, in my life, So I like, mm-hmm. I feel that there's a great portion of our society that's like disconnected, that might be disconnected from that, from those baser sort of senses and emotions, So I really like to be able to look backwards like that through the cheese, And I think the cheese is interesting in that way, how it contains specific moments in time in the past inside of it in a certain way.
Cheese and yogurt and other, soured milk products help us tell a much more complete story than if we were to be looking at just fresh dairy. There are many cultures where fresh dairy is not really consumed.
Yeah, totally.
Part of it has to do with the fact that, refrigeration and some of these other techniques have come to them much later. And there was just never a cultural development there, but dairy products that can be stored, can be held, have become very important. And I'm thinking particularly of, Central Asia and the Mongolian Empire,
right,
where fresh dairy, it was consumed if you milked and, stood there and had a drink. But other than that, carrying yogurts and cheeses across the plains was a very important part of the diet. And there is archaeological evidence to back up some of the, the chemical analysis and residue analysis that pertains specifically to cheese making as opposed to yogurt or fresh dairy, which is a series of what we think are probably strainers that have been recovered from archaeological sites, which are largely ceramic but with perforated bottoms.
Where are those coming
and
from?
There are some that have come out of the area around Turkey, the Middle East.
That makes sense.
And they were a real curiosity when they were first excavated. People are like, what are these things? Like, what are they using them for? And once again, they went to do some chemical residue analysis, and sure enough, they're coming up with dairy proteins, milk proteins.
That's pretty awesome,
and
man.
That's actually the first direct evidence for not only the use of dairy, but the fact that they're straining it, which to those of us who know anything about cheese production says
you need
cheese
to do
production.
That.
Yeah, and they've also found some with later dates coming out of places as far away as Ireland. And,
Wow.
Throughout Europe, as soon as they had cows, they moved into cheese making right away. That cheese making probably came with those first cows that were brought into the area.
I always look at my cheese timeline like that, and when I look at the history that I know, it always goes from like Middle East and like Cyprus to Greece, and then Greece to Rome, and then Rome to everywhere else. I don't know why, but I think. Or that's how I see it in my mind, because of the way societies conquered one another, or the way people, like you said, the large migrations of people, or that's how I see it. Maybe am I off there? Am I pretty far off there? Or
cheese making in actually most of these regions probably predates the Roman Empire. We're talking about the early Neolithic package moving through. Which would have been earlier. So when the Romans moved in, there would have already been
established
sheep and goats and pigs and all the things that go with those, including cheese making. So it would have happened on a smaller scale. We're talking about small villages, homesteads, things like that. They were already one of my areas of research is in Iron Age Ireland, and by the Iron Age in Ireland. They had a predominantly dairying economy, that their economy really relied mostly on dairy production.
Where did it all come from? Were these just all windfall, discoveries? I know it's like you said, it's hard to find the flashpoint, the first. But Where did it all come from? Is it just an inherent knowledge of how to use the milk by the people who have the animals?
Like, it probably came with the animals when they got the animal. So it would have been discovered right along with domestication, that they're domesticating the animals. Those first people to have the animals figured out, like, oh, we can make this tasty stuff out of milk if we go through this process. Their neighbors see what they're doing, and they're like, huh, maybe if I, you know, get one of those cows, I can do that same thing.
Sure.
And then their neighbors see it, and their neighbors see it, and their neighbors see it. So it was just kind of spread in a very organic way until it, you know, reaches the far corners. And the evidence is now suggesting that when they saw their neighbors with their first cows, those neighbors were probably already enjoying dairy products.
So you're saying that – so domestication of cows, 10,000 years. So cheese is over 10,000 years old? Is that what you're telling me?
That's what the evidence is suggesting.
I like that. I like that. That's a long history.
A really long time.
That's great. I love that. That's fantastic. So
– And I just absolutely love the idea of the first person to decide to milk a cow and eat cheese. I mean, we have
that is a good person
with
right
it because
there.
we are mammals ourselves, and we are, you know, feeding our own children.
Right.
But the idea that you are look at the cow and you're like, there's this like white excretion coming, whitish yellow excretion coming out of that animal, and then I'm going to let it sit here and get kind of nasty and funky
right.
until it gets chunks in it, and then I'm going to eat that.
Yeah, sounds
and
great to
the
me.
The first person to make that jump is just my personal hero.
They must have been very thirsty or very hungry. Do you know what I mean? Like they're like you know what I'm saying? Because the way you just described that, it's just like, weird goo. Let's rot it and eat it. Yum. That sounds great.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, it sounds fantastic. That's how I make my living.
Thank God they did. That's exactly my take on it.
So, you know, I mean, if your listeners are interested in learning more about this topic, you know, I know that Paul Kinstedt goes into a lot about the origin of cheese in his book called Cheese and Culture. But for our listeners, are there any other resources you know of that, like, you know, that regular folk can look into?
Yeah, unfortunately, most of the stuff that I deal with is in pretty dry academic journals.
Right.
There is a really great project that I do suggest people checking if people are interested in archaeology and particularly that residue analysis. They have a great acronym. It's LECHE, which is out of a lab in France, and they do have a website, which I believe is LECHE.org.
That's easy to remember.
Yeah, is a really fantastic project, and they're a consortium of researchers who are all pulling data from different areas to kind of tell the story of milk.
That's great. Well, we got to check that out. So, well, I want to say to everybody, you know, thanks for listening to our show this week. And thank you so much, Kalila, for coming on. Like, I learned super, super amounts of useful information from you this week. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it. I hope you get home soon, you know.
Thanks so much for having me.
You bet. Stay tuned next week. We'll be chatting with the Skinner sisters, who co-founded Culture Magazine. Have a great week, everyone. Take care.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.